Today in Studio 360.
Okay, here's a D. Here's an E-flat.
West meets East.
To play this music, just play it out of tune. Now, the fact that I'm saying out of tune implies that you're coming from a certain place.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma teaches me some music appreciation.
Now, step across and say, I welcome this as something beautiful. It is revelatory.
And later, best-selling Muslim superheroes arrive in America.
I wanted something that any kid could read anywhere in the world. You know, if you're Muslim, great. Just like, you know, my kid is reading Spider-Man now in Arabic. Spider-Man's mantra, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. That's beautiful. What culture wouldn't espouse that as their own?
That's all ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Yo-Yo Ma is going to stop by today to give us a cello lesson, and we'll hear about a punk band who's trying musical theater. But first, Boston. This week, Ben Affleck makes his debut as a director with a film called Gone Baby Gone. The movie is set in a rough-and-tumble Irish neighborhood in Boston, pretty much the same locale as Clint Eastwood's Mystic River and Martin Scorsese's The Departed. A sequel to The Departed is already in the works, and Studio 360's Eric Malinsky has been keeping his eye on this bumper crop of Boston movies. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Kurt.
So why are you such a Boston movie buff?
Well, I grew up in the Boston area, and, you know, as a kid, I was kind of obsessed with anything that took place in Boston, and pretty much nothing was even remotely accurate until Good Will Hunting.
But is that your thing? You come into a bar, you read some obscure passage, and then pretend you pawn it off as your own idea just to impress some girls, embarrass my friend?
And I remember the first time I saw that, thinking, oh my God, somebody's taken notice, you know, of the city and the incredible sort of tensions that are within the city.
One, don't do that. And two, you dropped 150 grand on a f***ing education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library.
Where you grew up, in the suburbs outside Boston, was not exactly the get-your-face-punched-in, hard-drinking world of a lot of these movies.
No, it's not. I've always told people I'm from Boston because I love Boston, but I mean, and I always wished I actually was from the city, but I was, you know, of course, from the suburbs. But my family's been there for, you know, like 150 years, and my mom's side of the family have very thick Boston accents. They're from Quincy.
And Boston accents, for people who didn't grow up in Boston, are almost impossible to do. Right.
Yes. Yes, they they definitely are.
I mean, like in The Departed. I mean, there's some okay ones, but there are a lot of really not quite there ones.
I don't know why it's so hard, but I mean, it's as a local, I mean, when you hear somebody get it wrong, it's just like, you know, nails on a blackboard, although some people seem to think the Boston accent alone is nails on a blackboard. I kind of like it. I mean, again, you know, I'm used to it. I grew up with it. But, you know, we actually talked to a bunch of people in Boston and we asked them what they thought were some of the worst Boston accent movies. And, of course, we got some clips of some of the worst ones as well.
Hi. Boy. He's here. Answer the door.
And then we get to choose who we let into our weird little worlds.
The Boston accents. I don't think they're real. I think they're phony.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio. Real bad.
Call this number on a dead guy's phone. Who are you?
The Good Will Hunting guys got it wrong, too. They're from Cambridge.
Thanks a lot. Yes, I have the floor now.
If you're a real Bostonian, you can pick that right out. Those guys, you know, they tweak their...
Just ham it out of his gourd. Just brat.
Their Cambridge accents sound like they're from Boston, but they're not from Boston. They're Cambridge.
We got them out of the car, trying to make them walk the line. He gets out of the car.
It's not only about dropping your R's. It's about putting your R's where they don't belong. I had a good idea, but then I drank too much beer.
Dennis Lehane writes novels set in Boston, including Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone.
People in Boston cannot hear how bad their accents actually are. And so, I mean, I would have people say, I thought like Matt Damon, I thought he was just going a little hard on that accent, you know?
Lehane thinks that Matt Damon gets it right, but not just the accent. Damon's a local. He gets the attitude.
There was just these little tiny things he did that showed exactly the size of the chip on this guy's shoulder and the fear he had that he would be found out as somebody who didn't belong in the party. So there's a scene in a French restaurant where he's with the girlfriend, he's trying to impress her, and he says, I just can't believe they didn't have duck l'orange.
Yeah, they got this, but they don't get duck l'orange.
Was your meal okay?
Yeah, no, the lobster was good. I just, because it was a French restaurant. Yeah. I'm surprised.
I did have a moment a couple of years ago, a very Matt Damon-esque moment, where a guy said, well, can you afford this? And I said, I made X number of dollars last year. How much you make? And walked off the lot. And that's just something that never goes away. Because you were talked down to so many times. Just if you said you were from Dorchester, people immediately, they took a little step back and there was a little flicker in their eyes.
It seems like every Boston movie ends up being about class. There are some Harvard movies like Legally Blonde, but for the most part, Hollywood likes to set Boston movies in the working-class Irish Catholic neighborhood of South Boston. Here's Ty Burr, a film critic for the Boston Globe.
In a sense, it's the most defining closed community of Boston, made up of people who didn't found the city and were treated pretty poorly when they did get here and pretty much closed down the door, and they don't let strangers in. Their business is their business, and those secrets make for good drama.
That's why Dennis Lehane created the character of Patrick Kenzie. Kenzie's a private investigator who gets hired by locals because he understands the neighborhoods. But his allegiance to his clan costs him a lot. Casey Affleck plays him in the movie version of Gone Baby Gone.
That's what he told you?
That's it.
Nothing else?
Yeah, he said that he wanted you two off his lawn.
I thought you said you knew this guy. Half the guys he knows are degenerates.
Yeah, you know what the other half are?
What?
Cops. Don't hold it against me.
No. I won't hold it against you.
Hollywood has other reasons for picking Boston. In 2005, the state of Massachusetts created tax credits that are luring film work away from Canada. With the Canadian dollar so strong, you can expect to see a lot of pretty postcard pictures of downtown Boston in the coming years. Also, a movie like Mystic River or The Departed can update the crime genre and explore issues of class without really touching more controversial issues of race. A white actor who might normally get cast as a yuppie in love or a superhero can get the chance to play a modern-day Bogart or Cagney. But race still comes up.
That opening montage in The Departed, where they touch on the history and they have images of the busing riots, and that had my heart going because I was convinced, oh my God, we're going to go someplace in a Boston movie that we've never been taken before and that we desperately need to go.
But now, I don't know, it's a funny thing. It put hate in your heart.
The Knights of Columbus were real headbreakers, true guineas.
And then it went away and the movie, settled down into Southie and Dorchester and became, the crime thriller that it was.
The white neighborhoods fought school desegregation bitterly in the courts and on the streets. The busing crisis left a huge psychological scar across the city. Ty Burr thinks it would make a great movie, but he's not holding his breath.
I think a lot of people in Boston don't want it to be addressed in a Boston movie, or it'll be awfully painful to confront. But that's drama.
Well, I think what it did was it influenced me heavily as a writer, because what I saw was oversimplification going on everywhere. And so you have this thing, and you couldn't discuss it without then somebody being very quickly able to step up and say, well, you're just a racist. Are you defending racism? And you say, no, good Lord, no, I'm not. But please don't live across the river in a $2 million home in Cambridge and tell me what life is like in South Boston.
Gentrification is changing neighborhoods like Southie, just when Boston's gritty authenticity is being immortalized on film. Dennis Lehane feels an extra responsibility to capture what he sees and what he hears.
There's a lot of bad here, but then there's also something really wonderful about a place where you speak in a certain shorthand, where everybody does know who you are, where everybody's funny. I think, and that's where people say, hey, you're getting it. You're not coming in as a tourist. You're not pointing fingers. And when you do sort of say that this is some of the dirty laundry, you're also saying, but hey, look how nice it looks sometimes when it's strung across the lines between two tenements.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
If there's a movie that gets your city totally right on or completely wrong, tell us about it. at studio360.org. Right across the Charles River, there's another Bostonian doing his city proud, Yo-Yo Ma, the virtuoso cellist, Grammy Award winner, and extremely nice guy. He has gotten a lot of attention over the last decade for leading the Silk Road Ensemble, which is a group that draws its members and music from countries all across Asia. Spending so much time on the road, Yo-Yo Ma gets really close to his travel companion.
This is nicknamed Petunia.
Yeah.
It's
so you're like B.B. King. You name your instruments.
Yeah, Lucille and Petunia. Maybe they'll meet one day, you know, because I love B.B. King. So Petunia was named by a high school student. Her name's Brittany, and she asked, do you have a name for your cello? I said, I don't. But if you think of a good name, maybe I'll use it. And Petunia sounded pretty good.
Tell me more about this instrument. Is it really, really old and really, really fine?
It is 1733, and it was made in the city of Venice. And I love it because it has a really rich, deep voice. And it growls when you need it to and sings and soars when you'd like it to do otherwise.
Is it the one you left in a taxi cab?
That'd be the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Has she forgiven you?
Yes. She wouldn't talk to me for a couple of days, but then after that, we're now good buddies.
Now, when you wake up in the morning and you sit down to practice, as I assume you do, what do you first do? What do you first play?
Well, I do something like... I've become friends with the instrument.
Uh-huh.
I try not to tax it too much. It's really like warming up a car or warming up your body.
Uh-huh.
You stretch it.
Uh-huh.
You don't go into a fast run. You don't take it to 60 in 3 seconds or whatever. Because what's funny about an instrument made out of wood, every day the humidity is different.
Mm-hmm.
Every day the temperature is different, and wood, as well as our bodies, are slightly different. So I think it's actually making that relationship happen.
Mm-hmm. And once you do get it warmed up, what are you inclined to play?
I might play some Bach, which is something that I started learning as soon as I started playing, and it's also something that's written for cello alone. This is music that is somewhat meditative. And
show,
I'll to play.
Show, don't
I
tell.
Will play. Here, this is show and tell.
I'll be back in a minute with Yo-Yo Ma in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is the first Bach cello suite. Yo-Yo Ma plays this piece, as he is now, every single day. But it's not just to warm up his fingers. For him, it's sort of like meditation.
I think of the flow of water,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, the light, afternoon light playing in the on leaves, so that you see something that is familiar and yet it's different every day.
Is it really? I mean, you must have played that piece of music hundreds and hundreds of times. You know,
yeah,
thousands, maybe.
But what's amazing is that, you know, I could, with a great friend, you could see them thousands of times and you don't look at them and say, well, today I'm really bored with you.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. But I learned it playing this way. As a four-year-old. And, you know, until sometime around I was a teenager, I thought, you know, I look at the score and it's written different bowing, so I tried that. And then at some point I was asked by the head of the Schweitzer Institute. He wanted me to talk about Bach. And so suddenly, having to verbalize music that I had known forever took me to another way of thinking about sort of, well, Bach, Schweitzer described, was a pictorial composer. And then I thought about, well, what does that mean? So one of the things that he coded was infinite variety. Instead of the materiality of saying, this is the same thing, I need a new product. it's something new every time.
Do you think that's a common feeling among musicians playing a repertoire, or is the fact that the cello repertoire is so relatively limited force you to find the endless variety in what you have to play?
Well, I think I would probably answer it more in terms of when our children would say, I'm bored. It's you're laughing, you're smiling because you've heard the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, things aren't boring, but people can be boring. I think there's so much to explore in cello repertoire, but I think what's more interesting to me is how people do music differently, because my big passion is actually people.
Yeah, and I've talked to people who've worked with you, and they say that you have an uncommon lust for collaboration.
Lust. I like that. I like that.
And the Silk Road project, obviously, is an example of that. This record you put out not long ago, Appalachia Waltz, with mm-hmm. a fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful tango music by Astor Piazzolla.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such great music. I'm interested in figuring out when do we get great films coming out of certain places? When do we get great novels coming out? And why does that happen? Why does music come out of certain areas? Astor Piazzolla is a great example. He was someone who was a hybrid, taken to Manhattan when he was very young, listened to jazz, went to Paris, studied with Nadia Boulanger, lived in Uruguay. And it's all of those influences that created the new tango, for which he was kicked out of his own taxi cab because the cab driver thought he was toying with a sacred tradition, which was at that time not yet 100 years old.
I expect your children must have been astounded when their father many times, I believe, appeared on Sesame Street. Let's listen to a little bit of Yo-Yo Ma on Sesame Street.
Mr. Ma, want to play with Elmo?
Let's do it.
Okay.
He was practicing the violin and he got stuck on a scale, and I helped him through that note. And I feel that I have played a small part in Elmo's musical development.
Really?
Before he became Elmo the superstar.
So as Casals and Rostropovich are to you, you are to Elmo, I guess.
I think so. This is, he's never acknowledged that publicly, but
is there
happy.
Is there a feud here that I detect?
No. There's no feud there. No. I am just extremely proud of what he's contributed.
Now, when you were a little kid in the pre-Sesame Street age, at 7 you played for President Kennedy, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. At 16 you gave a recital at Carnegie Hall, and you got your first review in the New York Times, a rave.
It's probably my last rave review from the New York Times.
What was your offstage, non-performative life as a little kid and an adolescent like?
Well, I came from a very protective family. So I was kind of didn't go out much, didn't socialize a lot. And I think that was both a boon in terms of, you know, being very focused, very little television, whatever. So I had to sneak a transistor radio in the house so I could listen to what else was going on. And in my teenage years, I really was bursting to try and kind of get out and to figure out what the world was like. And what college gave me was to really appreciate there are many ways of exploring the world, and there are many people who are at least as passionate about what they were interested in as I may have been in music.
And that was new to you as a notion?
Absolutely. You know, people doing computer science, Fortran at that time, and sociobiology was coming into play, molecular biology, and it was mind-boggling to think about what people were exploring.
And out of those habits of mind from your rich liberal education, it seems to me it's natural that you started on your Silk Road project, which, for our listeners who don't know, looks at all of the musical trends from China through Southeast Asia and the Near East. What led you to this idea, which you've been doing now for 10 years? Was it a way to challenge yourself musically?
I think the more I look at something that I know well, such as the classical music tradition, the more I realize that that tradition was born out of many other traditions. So specifically, going to the Imperial Museum, the Shosoin collection in Nara, Japan, which is the early capital, and where Buddhism first arrived.
Near Kyoto.
Near Kyoto. Thank you. And you see instruments. There was one instrument in particular, a pipa, a biwa, which is a strummed instrument, pear-shaped, and it had a painting in leather of a Chinese landscape of a Persian man and an elephant. And then in the back are sort of like mother-of-pearl inlays and two beautiful red stones. And those stones only come from East Africa.
Wow.
And
there it is.
There it is. And it says, okay, from 800, here's some evidence of, you know, people really taking in what was all around and making it their own.
Globalization 1.0, I guess.
Exactly. That's right.
There must be particular tunes that you're playing where it's hard to play on your 18th century Venetian cello music that is Eastern. Is that translation hard, just technically?
Well, I'll give you an example of something. So many people, many of our listeners know what the piano sounds like. And there's piano intonation. I think one of the things that is different are actually the intervals. So let's say you have a scale that goes, starts with D and then. Now, we hear. But this is one. That's what it would sound like on the piano, the all located notes. Now, there's a mode in Persian music that's if you play. You play this note a little sharper. Now, to play this music, just play it out of tune. Now, the fact that I'm saying out of tune implies that you're coming from a certain place. But if I say, let's take this reality, that this is really beautiful. And if you step across and say, I welcome this as something beautiful. And so if you play this there and you say, this is extraordinary and it is revelatory because it really takes you not only into a beautiful place inside, it actually takes you possibly in this piece to the color blue in the city of Naishapur, ancient city of Naishapur in ancient Persia. Suddenly, what does the imagination conjure up?
It seems like a great illustrative metaphor for the way maybe we should begin to think about talking to people in Persia about larger, facts of life. Those points of view are fundamental and mm-hmm. often so disparate.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right, because I think one of the things that we learned, and this is a political truth. We went last year to Azerbaijan, to Baku, which is a city that Rostropovich was born in. So here's like, you know, one of my great idols, born in the capital of Azerbaijan, which is the second country to the right of Turkey. So Azerbaijan was part of Persia in the 1800s. But in a war with Russia, where Persia lost, Azerbaijan was given to Russia. And there are apparently millions and millions of Azeris that live in Iran today. Didn't know that. We think of Iran as a country, but actually its history is easily over 5,000 years old. I think to have a conversation, it helps to know that.
Do you think that kind of, the kind of fusion music you're doing, sort of saying that the classical repertoire is not limited to what was composed by Europeans 150 years ago, is part of the process of making sure there'll be audiences in 50 years from now?
Well, I think any tradition that doesn't continually evolve will eventually become smaller. And I feel I'm a better musician playing Bach today.
Really?
After having done 8-9 years of the Silk Road Project, because I just feel so much more liberated in just feeling as a human being, first of all. Secondly, instead of feeling like, oh, gee, I am enslaved to the printed note, I realize there are probably, you know, 29 more ways of doing anything. And that if we're exploring all the different ways that music has ever been made and we participate in it, that gives us so much more choice than saying, oh, I'm a performer, I'm a recreative person, you're a creative artist, and you write the stuff, and I don't want to know what you're drawing from. But if we know all of this stuff, it actually makes for one of the preconditions for greater creativity.
Has there been one surprise discovery about these musical traditions of which you were presumably not entirely fluent when you began that sticks with you? Like, geez, I just had no idea that in Azerbaijan they have this thing, or in Pakistan they do X.
Oh, I think there is like constant surprises. You know, one of my favorite stories is Sandeep Das, who's from Delhi and comes in for rehearsal in New York for a Persian piece that Kayhan Kalhor, the great Kemanche player from Iran, has written. And he literally steps off the plane at Kennedy, arrives, you know, cheerful, charming, ready to go. We play through this 23-minute piece, and he says, can we do it again? And we look at our watch and says, you know, we have a two-hour rehearsal, and this time is short. Why don't we start from measure 161? And he says, well, I wish I could, but I don't read music. But if you do it once more, I will know the whole piece by heart. That's a different way of learning.
Yo-Yo Ma, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today and bringing Petunia.
Thank you, Kurt. It's wonderful to be on your show.
When Yo-Yo Ma took up the cello, he was only 4 years old. When Ken Laws took up ballet, he had children older than that. It wasn't easy to find a dance class for middle-aged men. So as he told Studio 360's Hillary Frank, Ken just went along with his kids. They were 5 and 7 at the time.
The next tallest person was about half my height.
Ken started ballet at 40. He's 72 now. Surprisingly, he was much better than the kids at first. But then a couple years into his training, something really made his head spin.
The teacher would say, now do a tendu to the side.
That's when you stand at the bar and move your foot to the side with a pointed toe.
And then she'd say, now lift the leg, but don't move anything but the leg. And I would stand there thinking, yeah, sure, the center of gravity is moving off to the right side. So when you lift the leg, you're going to topple over, of course.
The center of gravity means a lot to Ken. When he wasn't taking children's ballet classes, he was teaching college physics. So he was shocked when he looked around the room and all the kids were lifting their legs and not falling over.
And I thought, wait a minute, how come these little kids can violate the laws of physics the way I've known the laws of physics for the last 30 years?
It took Ken a minute to figure it out. the kids were just cheating.
They start off a little bit asymmetric. They lift the leg for a very short time so they don't have time to topple. And they're applying a little bit of force on the bar to keep themselves from toppling.
And then once you learned that, did you discover that you could do what the teacher was asking you to do?
Oh, sure. I learned to cheat. But I also learned that this dance studio is a physics laboratory. There's all sorts of physics going on in here.
That's when Ken really fell for ballet, and he fell hard. So hard that he kept taking kids' classes even after his own kids quit. He danced in local productions, often playing both the party host and Mother Ginger within one performance of the Nutcracker. The more he practiced, the more questions like these kept popping into his head.
What's happening to the torque? Where is my moment of inertia? Where am I getting the force to make this happen? Am I conserving energy?
Ken started tinkering and built a ballet training bar that measured the amount of force exerted on it by a dancer. He rigged it to a projector and brought it with him to lectures. He started teaching dance classes of his own.
The leg is thrown out by centrifugal force, but when it's thrown out, the moment of inertia is larger, the angular velocity decreases, you're going more slowly.
Eventually, Ken figured he'd amassed enough information on physics and dance to write a book. He called it simply The Physics of Dance.
And I thought, oh, people are going to gobble this up. It's natural.
I was like, are you trying to teach me school or ballet? Like, what is this?
Sarah Michelle Morosky was 11 when she first read one of Ken's books.
I don't know. He has like something like this in it. FP equals W, LC. I don't know how to even say it now.
Sarah Michelle's 16 now, studying ballet in Philadelphia. She used to help Ken demonstrate at some of his seminars. At nearly 5'10" with a skinny ballerina body, she's prone to falling over. Ken taught her all kinds of ways to adjust her weight over her center. The results were immediate.
It was kind of one of those moments that Ken always talks about. He says it's the aha moment, and it's like, oh my gosh, I just realized what I needed to fix.
And that's the most exciting part about teaching with, you know, this science. They get so excited when they apply the physical principles to their dancing.
Arlene Sugano uses Ken's methods in her classes in Little Rock, Arkansas. She sees the biggest results when she's teaching turns.
What does it take to turn? Torque.
Torque. Remember torque? Yeah, probably not. Torque is two opposing forces acting on an object.
And how do we produce multiple turns? Well, you have to increase the duration of the torque. So how would we do that? Well, we would plié longer. And so you would stay in that bent knee position as you did this twisting of the feet.
Maybe that sounds hard to follow, but Arlene's 13-year-old's got it.
All of a sudden, I hear screaming and jumping up and down and screaming, Miss A, Miss A, oh my God, I just did four turns. And I start crying.
You start crying?
Oh yes. And they all laugh and they clap because they say, we did it, we made her cry.
Sarah Michelle agrees that, yes, all this physics business helps with doing lots and lots of turns. But what Ken and Arlene would tell her to do if she needed to pull off more than three pirouettes is wind up her arms to build momentum.
But in terms of the ballet technique, most teachers would really get mad if you did that winding up thing. They just want you to be able to turn without getting any momentum or anything.
Turns out a lot of dance teachers think it's blasphemous to talk about classical ballet in scientific terms. That point of view was captured in this Philadelphia Inquirer headline. He wants to reduce ballet to a science.
He wants to reduce ballet to a science. That made me cringe. I wanted to crawl into a hole. I thought, how did I give that impression? That's the last thing in the world I want to do.
Do those people have a point at all? Like, does making art seem scientific take the art out of the art?
Yes, in fact, am I thinking about physical principles when I'm performing on stage? Not at all. You don't want to muddy your mind with the science when you're trying to express the aesthetics of the art form.
The aesthetics of ballet are all about illusions. The artistry lies in dancers being able to fool us into believing they can turn without momentum or hang in midair.
You can fight against gravity, or you can accept and understand the logic of how gravity is working. And if you understand the logic, then you can work within those constraints.
Really, Ken isn't trying to force physics on anyone. He just loves dancing.
What do I love about dancing? Pas de deux. I love to dance with a woman. There's just something magical about the way the minds have to think differently but have to think the same. To my mind, the classical ballet pas de deux is the epitome of human life.
For Studio 360, I'm Hilary Frank.
We've got more stories about those special places where science and art intersect that you can hear at studio360.org. Coming up, cartoon superheroes from the Middle East land in the U.S., 99 of them.
The 99 are very much like the X-Men. The X-Men are a way of talking about difference, about, you know, gender difference and sexual difference and racial difference and cultural difference.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A new comic book goes on sale this month, which is nothing special. This one looks and feels like a fairly typical superhero story, but The 99 is very different. One of the heroes is Jabbar from Saudi Arabia. He has superhuman strength. And Dana Ibrahim can sense good and evil in people. They are two of the 99, a group of superhuman Muslim teenagers trying to protect the world. Brooke Dara Schumann talked to the creator of the 99, Naif Al-Mutawa, who, just like a lot of us, fell in love with comics when he was a kid.
I still remember the way Batman smelled, for some reason, the comic, the actual paper and the ink.
Naif Al-Mutawa discovered Batman visiting the U.S. at that quintessential American institution, summer camp.
At Camp Robin Hood. Actually, ironically, my son Hamid, my eldest, after his first summer there, he said, "Baba, I found this new comic called Archie." And I was like, "New comic, huh?" You know, same place I found it myself.
Mutawa eventually went to business school and became the CEO of Teshkil Media Group, distributing Western comics in the Middle East. The 99 is the company's first original comic. The idea came to him in a cab.
My sister turned to me in a cab ride on the way from London's Edgware Road to Harrods and said, "Naif, remember you told me that after you're done with school, you'd go back to writing?" And I said, "Yeah, I remember." She said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "You know, Samad, for me to go back now, the concept has got to have the potential of Pokemon. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense." My next thought was that there had been a fatwa issued against Pokemon. It was made un-Islamic in some markets. My next thought was, my God, what has happened to Islam? And who are these people making these decisions? My next thought was of Allah and how disappointed he must be. My next thought was that Allah had 99 attributes. And ironically, that brought me full circle back to Pokemon, which is a concept of a few hundred attributes. By the end of that cab ride, I got out of Harrods. I turned to my sister and I said, "What do you think of this?" I said, "If I wanted to create superheroes based on an Islamic paradigm, this is how it would work. Muslims believe that power is Allah, and Allah has 99 attributes. And Muslims believe, la ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. But those attributes are also human attributes, but not at the same level. Attributes like strength, wisdom, foresight, mercy, kindness, and dozens of others that are not used today to describe Islam in the media. So the idea is a series of heroes, each of which embodying one of these traits, yet needing to work in a team of three to solve a problem."
So Mutawa hired a team of illustrators and writers that were all veterans of DC and Marvel Comics. The result has bright colors, superheroes with big hearts, and sharp one-liners.
The style of the 99 is very much what American superhero comics looked like in the late 80s, early 90s. It's got that sort of big, bold, punchy, hyper-stylized, hyper-dramatic, hyper-foreshortened kind of look.
Douglas Wolk is a cultural critic. His new book is called Reading Comics.
The 99 are very much like the X-Men. The X-Men are a way of talking about difference, about, you know, gender difference and sexual difference and racial difference and cultural difference. In a lot of ways, the 99 is kind of an X-Men comic in Middle Eastern drag.
But the X-Men are all genetic mutants. The 99 get their powers from good old magic. The backstory is a little complicated.
In 1258, any school kid in that part of the world will tell you that the Mongols invaded Baghdad and destroyed it. And all the books from Dar al-Hikmah Library, the most famous library in the world at that time, were thrown in the Tigris River. And the Tigris changes color with ink. I rewrite that history, and I say the Mongols invaded Baghdad to destroy the library. That was their intent. But the librarians found out, and they got together a special solution of king's water that when mixed with 99 stones would be able to save all that culture and history and tolerance and advancement that Baghdad was known for at the time.
After that, though, there's not really very much of the flavor of the Middle East, of the flavor of Islamic culture about it, partly because, as I understand, the creators have tried to keep specific religious stuff out of it.
There is no mention of Islam in the books. Nobody prays. You know, when I was raising money for the concept, one of the people loved the concept, and he said to me, "So this is a fantastic idea. Are the characters going to pray?" That was his first question. I said, "How are they going to pray?" He said, "The Sunni way." I said, "Really?" And basically what I was trying to get to him is that I wanted something that any kid could read anywhere in the world. You know, if you're Muslim, great. Just like, you know, my kid is reading Spider-Man now in Arabic. Spider-Man's mantra, you know, "With great power comes great responsibility." Well, that's beautiful. What culture wouldn't espouse that as their own? The same thing I'm trying to do with the values of Allah. I mean, generosity, strength, wisdom. I mean, who wouldn't want their kids growing up with those as their values?
But every comic needs a supervillain. And the 99's is Ruhal. He was born in the 15th century, at the time when Ferdinand and Isabella were at war with Islam in Spain. Now he wants to assemble the 99 stones into a kind of God-powered weapon.
He still wants to use religion to fight because he's worried of these things happening again. So he doesn't do it with an evil intent, but religion, like everything else, can be used for good or for bad. The struggle for the 99 stones is for the struggle of the use of religion.
It really sort of backs away from politics as it relates to relations between the West and the Middle East. One of the big annoying things that Western comics do when they talk about the Middle East is immediately bring in terrorism. It's like a word association game. That's something that you would think that if the 99 is aimed partly at a Western audience, which it seemed to be, they might want to address, and that's something I really wish the 99 had more of.
You know, I interviewed for Columbia Business School 3 weeks after 9/11. And at that point in my life, somebody who's related to my grandfather, you know, the Wall Street Journal had written up a piece about whether or not he was involved in funding bin Laden. So question three in my interview was how I was related to this person. And I didn't know how to answer. I was like, if I said, you know, he's my grandfather's cousin and I have no follow-up question, I'm gone. I'm not getting into business school. So I said to him, I said, politically or socially? And he said, both. I said, well, socially, he's my grandfather's cousin. Politically, I have nothing to do with him. He's like, are you sure? I said, absolutely. But it just hit me in the face, like up close and personal, that if I don't do something about it and other people like me don't do something about it and we just sit back and, you know, just complain and grumble about the way we're being viewed by other people, we're going to get nowhere fast.
For Studio 360, I'm Brooke Schumann.
You can see some of the 99 at studio360.org. I was a huge comic book reader as a kid, but I stopped around 1970. By the end of that decade, I was a big punk rock music fan, going to CBGB's in New York. The Extraordinaires are a punk band today in Philadelphia, and you know the type. Sweaty guys, smelly club, amps turned up to 11. But last summer, without a budget and without any experience in theater, they got it into their heads to put on a musical for reasons known only to themselves. and to our reporter, Jesse Dukes.
We don't want to put on a normal rock show ever again, ever anymore.
This is Jay Purdy, songwriter and singer for The Extraordinaires.
I think that rock shows have gotten incredibly boring. I mean, it seems like just like a couple of few dudes getting on stage and playing, like, you know, loud music.
It's not that The Extraordinaires don't love loud music. They do. But their songs tell stories, often whimsical stories.
Storytelling is just such a brilliant way of conveying human emotion, because I think it's fun for people. It's an escape. They can listen to the music and they can unload their emotions onto characters.
I'd introduce myself, but you already know by the flag that I'm flying overhead that I'm the captain of the finest ship in the ocean.
2 years ago, Jay and the band wrote an album called Ribbons of War, a concept album. Tells the tragic story of a sailing ship captain in love with an aviator, kind of an Amelia Earhart. It sounds all pirate chic and gimmicky, but Jay was serious.
The album of Ribbons of War is based on, like, my first serious relationship, and I was a very jealous person back then.
At shows, they performed the songs in sailor costumes and narrated parts of the story, but that didn't work so well.
If you're trying to tell a cohesive story from beginning to end, people are going to get lost because they're going to be going to the bar and coming back, or they're just going to be talking to their friends or going out to smoke cigarettes.
They wanted the audience to sit down and pay attention, and so they decided to stage it for real, with props, costumes, actors, dialogue. They tried to get some funding from the city of Philadelphia, and that fell through. And so they did it anyway.
Wings of the Serious Island. Okay.
They begged favors, shanghaied friends, raided dumpsters and thrift stores to build the set. They recruited Amelia Meath, a dancer on her summer break from college, to work on it full time. She's the female lead, Annalise.
I really believe in The Extraordinaires. I think that Jay and Matt have an amazing work ethic. They didn't go to college, but they're just out there and making amazing things. And that's really exciting to me. It makes me feel like I could do that.
That is blasphemy! The captain would never bring a woman on board this ship!
The entire cast, 7 people, wrote the script together, democratically, based on Jay's concept. They had fun, and they did a great job making it funny. But remember, Jay had written a tragedy.
I don't think that we were at all capable of bringing to the stage the story that I originally intended to portray.
Ladies and gentlemen of Charlottesville, Virginia, take heed in our desperate words.
The debut is in Charlottesville, Virginia, where 3 of the Extraordinaires grew up. 80 people are crowded into the small black box theater. They spill out into the aisles.
For tonight, you look not upon me, but at the ghosts of men.
What?
Ghosts in here?
Sure, it's an easy hometown crowd, but right away they're laughing at all the right places.
You know, I'm going to have to ship out tomorrow.
I know. But you'll come back for me, won't you?
Jack Wilmerth, with the red coat, mutton chops, and thigh boots, makes a believable sea captain. Amelia, in her flying cap and goggles, gets to show off some fancy moves while she's singing.
When he left the shore, he promised he'd return.
In the story, the captain becomes jealous and arrogant, and as he does, the audience's mood changes. People seem a little disturbed as he locks Annalise in his cabin.
This is for your own good, Annalise.
I really think that it's important for you to care about these characters. I think we've done a good job of skirting the edge of it, especially near the war song. And you get to see the captain and Annalise kind of doing their final dance together after they've realized all these things about themselves. So I think that we achieve that in that moment.
Jay's right. The crowd totally gets the tragedy. Even some of the scruffy and bearded punk rock fans are blinking away tears. Sure, Jay wanted a more dramatic play, but The Extraordinaires proved their point. This audience wants more and can handle more than those 4 guys playing loud guitar in a basement.
I feel like we've given Ribbons of War its last rites and we can finally move on.
For Studio 360, I'm Jesse Dukes.
We'll be right back.
The Extraordinaires are on tour right now, doing some of the songs from Ribbons of War. You can find out where to see them, and you can hear another song from their show at studio360.org. That is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Kevin Ryan,
Jillian Goodman,
Ben Conniff,
and our theme music is by David Dantino.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and SCG, whose charitable resources support FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, online at fjc.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Annie Lennox is a pop icon with a lot on her mind.
Half the world lives in a state of abject poverty, and it upsets me. Sorry, do I sound like I'm preaching?
A little bit.
Yes, I am.
Charming
way. I'm sorry.
It's a dark road.
Annie Lennox, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.